Hello, it's Tuesday, the 21st of February, and this is Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast exclusive to Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir, and I'm joined fresh from the ski slopes of, I'm not sure whether it's France or Switzerland, Alan, I'm sure you'll tell me in a moment, Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Afternoon, Alan, what are the three things we need to know this week?
Afternoon, Sarah. It was the French-Swiss borders, even. Aren't we lucky? So, but down to investments. So I thought we'd talk about, we had a very interesting guest in, a guest called Anatole Kaleski. He used to be a journalist. Do you know where he used to be a journalist before he became independent researcher?
Now, funny enough, when you invited me to join that session, I did a quick bit of Googling, and I believe, was he at The Economist? And I think he was also at The Times.
Wasn't he? The Times, yeah. So spot on, that's right. So The Times, and it's an interesting kind of backstory how he made a name for himself, especially in The Times, vital reading. And he started a separate research firm, which Coutts subscribes to, and as an example of independent research. And we had him in, and I wanted you to join because he has a very podcast style. So I thought it'd be, as well as the content. And 2 points from there. One, it was a challenge to us on yield curves. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about what we mean by that in terms of yield curves and why is that so important. And secondly, this also a challenge on getting back to 2% inflation and what's so important about 2% inflation anyway. I mean, he talked about many other things, but those two things I think are important. And then, sadly, because it is sad, because it was absolutely tragic, it's the one-year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So one year on, we'll just cover the market impact.
Yeah, because we're going to be picking up. I'm going to be doing a special podcast with Alex Little, who we picked up with last year. And we're going to be looking more for the sort of giving some background on the sort of military, sort of strategic sort of operations in Ukraine and how that might pan out over the coming year. Okay, fascinating. Well, as I say, yesterday's session was really, really fascinating. So let's pick up on that first point then. So yield curve and this idea of how reliable it is as a predictor of recessions, because we're all quite, maybe we cite it often as a predictor of recessions, don't we? An inverted yield curve.
So we're not alone, and the Coutts team here do use the yield curve, and rightly so. And so, but Anatole was making 2 points, one which was strong, one which was weaker. He was basically saying it's not a particularly reliable indicator in the United States. And the way he used that was to go back way, way in time, basically to 1940. But the fact is, he's right, 1940 to say, I don't know, 1960, it wasn't a reliable indicator. So for 20 years or 15 years post-war, it wasn't. But actually, since 1970, really, so, you know, pretty modern times, it has been a pretty reliable indicator. But he made some good points, and why it's worth considering this time may be different, those dangerous words, is that he pointed out that the players in the bond market are so different now. So liability driven investment, it happens globally, not just here in the UK that we've talked about before. You've got central banks clearly. So the basic argument, it may be distorted. That was argument one, but his stronger argument was closer to home here in the UK. Because as he pointed out, I hadn't exactly forgotten it, but I put it to the back of my mind. In the UK, from 1997, the UK yield curve was inverted. By inverted, we mean that, I'll give an example. If cash yields 5, I'm not sure it does, you say, and 10-year bonds yield 4, that's inverted. And what's strange about that? Well, 5 on cash is guaranteed right now.
Yeah.
Earning 4 on 10-year bonds seems, well, why would you do that? And therefore, it's an indicator of stress. But for 10 years, from 1997, the yield curve was inverted and no recession. And he points to that as being a special period when pension funds first started to really start getting involved in the gilt market. So, look, very interesting, didn't you think, Sarah?
I thought it was fascinating because, as I say, it challenged the orthodox thinking. So But he wasn't saying then that it's not a good predictor in the US now. It was perhaps historically, but he's saying in the UK it doesn't necessarily mean if we've got an inverted yield curve, which actually, do we have an inverted yield curve?
No, not yet in the UK. But his point is he was using the UK as evidence. Right. Okay. And he says all you people, especially in Britain, ironically, who love the inverted yield curve as a signal, including us at Coutts, look, why aren't you saying the same about the UK? Because it hasn't been a good indicator. So it's a fair point. I would argue the UK is a more idiosyncratic market, as we saw with the Liz Truss quasi incident one. Yeah. And I would say, but in the US, it has been more reliable, but thought-provoking. So where does it leave Coutts and policy? Well, we had the key strategy members there, the key tactical team. They're going to take it away. It's one of many inputs that the Coutts teams gets, and they will take it into consideration. I think that's a very important part of the investment process, to listen to views that may be somewhat counter to our own, because as many listeners will know, the tactical team are somewhat cautiously positioned right now. And one of the key indicators they do look at is the yield curve.
Yeah, and I think also it's important, isn't it, to hear the counter argument, because then it questions your own orthodoxy, and then you may well decide that, well, actually, no, I know I'm right with what I'm doing because I've been challenged on it, but I think it's the right thing to do. So you can then proceed with confidence, can't you? So I think it is important to hear the other arguments and not just accept the orthodoxy. Okay, so that was one of the first sort of points he raised, and the second point, which we talked about this before, I found it really interesting, his point about this 2% inflation. So everybody's fixated on 2% inflation. You know, Andrew Bailey has to write to the UK government every so often and say, look, really sorry, inflation is still above 2%. Where does this 2% figure come from? Why is it the figure that every central bank has as their North Star for inflation? Why can inflation not be higher than 2% and be sustainable?
It's a great point. And of course, it could be. And interestingly, I'd forgotten this as well. Anatole told us which central bank in the world started it. It's fairly obscure. So Sarah, how hard were you listening? Can you remember?
No, was it the Bank of New Zealand?
It was. Very good.
See,
you're a great example to our investment staff. You listen carefully. It's very important to be a very good listener. Myself, I love to talk, but I absolutely listen. So he's making the point that, look, New Zealand Central Bank in the 1990s came up with this 2% forecast out of virtually nowhere. And everyone thought, wow, okay, that's a good idea. We'll copy it. To be fair, I was a bond manager back in those days in the 1990s. It was a way of New Zealand getting some credibility, having had a long-term inflation problem. So they said, okay, we're going to set a target. And really, it just caught on. One way of looking at it is that a little bit of inflation is okay, because disinflation, what Japan went through, is not good for an economy.
Yeah,
it's very hard for businesses when they have to keep cutting their prices all the time. That's the general synopsis there. And the idea is, well, about 2% is the right kind of grit in the system. And anyway, 2% is probably exaggerated by this strange world called hedonics. Do you know what hedonics means?
No, I don't know what
that's
hedonics
a hard
means.
Word. It's God, that's so patronizing. I don't mean to be, but it's improvements. It's improvements in stuff, like the iPhone improves every year, right?
Yeah.
And is that really taking into account inflation? So that's where 2% comes from. But you are quite right, and I think that's the point he's making, is that quite easily they could be comfortable with a 3-4% inflation rate. It doesn't have to be 2, notwithstanding the letters that the MPC have to write, or the governor on behalf of the governor of the central bank has to write here in the UK, has to write on behalf of the MPC to the Chancellor of Exchequer. So, yeah, I think that was a good point. And I, the wider point is, look out, which I think we have some more sympathy for. Yes, inflation is going to fall, but when it gets to 3-ish and, you know, the economies are struggling a bit, don't expect it to go all the way back to 2. Expect them to start taking action before then.
So are we thinking then that like 3%, 3.5% inflation is perhaps going to be the new normal? and that central banks will kind of gradually come round to, and they will just basically shift away from this 2% thing? Or would markets react then too strongly against that because they then fear that then inflation would be allowed to rise even higher if we're starting from a higher sort of basis point?
It's tough to know, but remember in the US, because it comes back to the US, in the US, their forecast changed from almost 2% to 2% over a cycle anyway. Mm. So they should be perfectly comfortable for 3% for a while, because to account for the fact that inflation occasionally goes to 1 or 0. So that could come back, but markets will be accepting of it, of around 3. It would be our judgment, but it is a close call and something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, I think it's, we're not expecting, even if we could get down to 2%, it's not going to happen this year anyway, is it? We're probably going to struggle to get down to 3%, aren't we, I think?
In Europe, and especially here in the UK, yes. In the US, there's an outsized chance we could get there because of the nature of US inflation, especially right now. What's driving it, for example, is housing. And that might be a bit of a surprise because housing is weak. Maybe not that weak, but it is weak. And that's because of the lagged effect that we have, or that they have, in terms of their inflation calculator. So there are some forecasts out there for 2% in the US. But really, I would, once they get to low 3, they're going to be saying, surely, job is done or job is nearly done.
Yeah. Okay. Time to take the foot off the tightening pedal. Okay, and then the last point, which is a sad point to reflect on, the fact that it is 12 months on from Russia invading Ukraine, which seems a remarkable thing, which seemed like such a tumultuous event at the time, and certainly for the people in Ukraine, it's continued to be the last year. But it does feel a little bit like, apart from now, because it's the year anniversary, it feels like it's kind of slightly slipped off the radar a little bit.
It does. I mean, and there's a lot worse things to discuss in the financial markets, but it's our job to discuss the financial market impact. Yeah. You know, it's a terrible situation out there, you know, with deaths on both sides. But our job is to focus on the financial markets. And so 1 year on, it's not that long. And we've said before, haven't we, Sarah, when there's a geopolitical event, what do you do? We've always said,
You buy into it, go against it.
Certainly not panic sell.
Yeah.
I'm pleased to say the Coutts team, there was no panicky sells or panicky buys. Because if you turn to maybe equities, a surprise, European equities are now up since then. Obviously, they did fall steeply. But 1 year on, they're up. And there's a lot of other things going on. US equities, less affected, you know, unchanged. But the remarkable aspect is, panic into gold, wrong. You know, gold has lost money. But even more remarkable, I'm looking at a chart of natural gas here. Natural gas, which has caused all the problems in Europe, a huge spike in natural gas prices, as we know, is now lower now than before the war. So is oil, by the way. But natural gas is the real standout. So basically, anything you panicked to do, the conventional wisdom, there's going to be an energy crisis, there's going to be a stock market crisis. Unless you got out very quickly like a trader, which is very difficult to do, you're now losing quite a lot of money from all those trades, or all that positioning. And so, look, we don't know when the next geopolitical event is going to happen. There will be one. But this hopefully put into investors and our colleagues' memory that you generally want to go against the initial conventional wisdom.
Yeah. And also, we tend not to make investment decisions based on the potential outcome of geopolitical events anyway, do we? Because it's what's known as a binary bet, isn't it? You're kind of betting on, like Brexit or whatever it might be, you're betting on the flip of a coin, essentially, what may or may not happen as a result of an action.
So definitely not before and after. I concede that maybe there's some sectors. So obviously oil stocks have performed really well, but there's two things going on there. Yes, oil is now lower, but they were really, really cheap stocks beforehand. So there's multiple aspects going on. And yes, there may be the odd stock where it becomes long lasting for whatever reason, the odd individual stock. But as we're talking about overall markets here, really, the best advice on almost any geopolitical event is to ignore it. Absolutely ignore it. And if you're brave enough, go against it. But that's hard. That is very hard.
Because ultimately, that's what markets do, isn't it? They move on from the geopolitical event. They might be a little bit of an initial reaction, but ultimately they move on and they get back into their own rhythm again, don't they? They don't completely just change the way they operate because of events, however tragic they may be in some parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to inflation, we talked about the kind of the 2% targets, etc. But again, I think it's more evidence that inflation is not down to Russia, Ukraine, because especially in the States, how can it be? Yes, there was supply chain, but it was down to, I think the evidence is very strong. It was down to, dare I say, the Liz Truss quasi type policy that Joe Biden got away with at a time of zero rates. Which was a huge fiscal expansion. That I'll call it the Larry Summers theory, because I'm not as smart as Larry Summers to be able to do that, but I was smart enough to know zero rates were crazy, as you know from me raving on this podcast. These geopolitical events, I'd be interested to hear what Alex has to say. And of course, we all hope it comes to an end at some stage. Interesting to see. I actually push him on what Henry Kissinger said, just lining up, because Henry Kissinger said Ukraine must concede some land to Russia. I'd be very interested in that. And of course, in public, no one, apart from people like Henry Kissinger, people aren't saying that. But whatever it takes to for peace is what I would say. But, you know, that's a personal view rather than a Coots view.
Yeah. The pragmatic approach. I will definitely raise that question with him when I speak with him later on in the week. Thank you very much, Alan. So just to run through then those sort of key summary points, we were very fortunate. We had Anatol Kolecki joining the Coutts strategy team this week, and I was very lucky to be invited into that session as well. A couple of points we came from that. The first one is that there's arguably yield curve as a measure of a metric of potential recession, particularly an inverted yield curve, he would argue is not a reliable indicator, especially pre-1970s in the US and, you know, 1997 to 2007 in the UK. It wasn't a presage of a recession. But very interesting to get those kind of thought-provoking, challenging sort of ideas to get the team thinking. Another one that was very interesting, the challenge, was this concept of 2% inflation and why are central banks so wedded to the concept of 2% inflation? And the fact that it actually came from the Bank of New Zealand in the 1990s, which was perhaps makes us think a little bit, well, maybe 2% is not the be all and end all. And it may well be that central banks do accept a figure, perhaps they may have to accept a figure closer to 3% as an acceptable level of inflation. We'll have to see how that plays out this year. And then obviously, last but not least, it's a year on from the war in Ukraine. But what it's taught us purely from a financial point of view, because obviously we're talking about the war in Ukraine and how it impacts markets. And we haven't talked about other major global events as well, like the terrible earthquake in Syria and Turkey. But we're talking from purely from a market point of view. The fact that these big geopolitical events, markets do tend to recover, they do tend to move on. And you've got to be very careful about responding, taking a knee-jerk reaction, responding, panicking either for or against a geopolitical event. And it's about keeping calm and sort of potentially buying into that geopolitical event, but not doing anything very quickly or too spontaneously. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording, and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com to access previous episodes. And as we discussed during this podcast, we'll be back later on in the week when I'm doing a special bonus episode with Alex Liddle, who we've spoken to before. He's ex-MOD. He was in the strategic team there at the MOD. So he knows a lot about sort of the military strategy that's playing out in Ukraine. And we'll be reflecting a little bit on what's been going on over the last 12 years, but importantly, how we see this playing out and how this conflict can be resolved over, well, hopefully, the not too distant future. That's all for the, well, that's all for the investment side of things for this week for Need to Know. We'll be back with some geopolitics. Until then, we'll see you next time for Need to Know. Bye-bye for now.